Hello there, this is Jonathan Ross introducing another edition of my regular movie podcast, I Like Films. And in this edition, I'll be talking to the brilliant and rising British film director, Ben Wheatley, who had High Rise out about a year ago. Before that, A Field in England, Sightseers, which was incredible, and probably my favourite of his movies, actually, Kill List. But let's talk about the new movie, which is out just now, I guess. It's just dropped now. Happy New Year, Colin Burstead. I would not have expected to see this kind of a movie from you. It's very different. It's not in any way, I would have thought, a genre film, if we use that in the broadest possible term. In terms of, like, you know, you've done horror. You've done kind of black, very dark comic with violence. You've done an incredible shootout movie, which I loved. But this isn't easily categorisable, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends how broad broad your definition of genre is, because I think there's definitely a genre which is people talking in rooms,
yeah,
which is, you know, which goes from like Bergman to EastEnders and to Woody Allen.
But
and
you
all
know
this
what I'm saying, yeah.
I know that you're yeah. saying, yeah. I wanted to basically, what it was this, is like I was 45 and I hadn't made a film but someone didn't die in it. And I thought, why is that? Why is there so much murder and
killing everyone,
violence in these things? And you know, you look at some people's careers and you see they never made a film where no one got murdered in
Tarantino.
It. And I thought, well, I feel a bit sad about that. And I wanted to, and also wanted to make something that was closer to my own experience, you know, and thought, you know, and go back into that.
I mean, it occurred to me when I was watching it that I wondered whether partly it was, you're clearly someone who likes collaborating with actors. And there are, you know, repeat cast members in this. I hesitate to call them, it's not like you have a coterie of actors you always use, but Neil in the lead role as Colin Burstead was fabulous in Kill List.
Yeah.
He's very good in this role. So I guess partly I assumed you wanted to work with him again, but I wondered whether this was a more pure interaction between director and actor.
No, I think the performance stuff is always pretty much the same, but it's, and you're right in that this film had kind of come from wanting to work with Neil Maskell again. So I'd kind of like, it was in the back of my mind that I do work with people repeatedly, and I hadn't really worked with him since Kill List, even though he's in High Rise. And I was like, why is that? That's bad, you know. So, and this project had started off as a kind of a thought kind of experiment for me, and then it had grown a bit. And I found it in the drawer and went, this looks like a Maskell project. Then I rewrote it for him specifically.
So what was the thought experiment that triggered it then?
It was when I was casting High Rise, and I'd gone to see Tom Hiddleston in Coriolanus, and I knew I had to talk kind of intelligently to him, and he'd been living.
So you had to fake it, really.
Well, exactly. He'd been living the life, you know, living this Shakespeare play for months.
Yeah.
And I had no idea, so I was looking at it on like Wikipedia, and I mean, it's a difficult of all the plays. It's a difficult one, and it's kind of very Elizabethan in a way that, you know.
It's almost Grand Guignol, isn't it? It's so over the top.
Yeah, but it's more the structure of it, that it's about a guy who. He has all this success at the beginning of the story, and then he's basically broken down and destroyed by everyone around him. And it's like, you'd never get that. Is not something that would get past a Hollywood development team these days, you know.
Third act is not pleasing to them.
I came away from it going, oh, I just about got past the conversation with Tom without him working out that I was an idiot. But I got back to my house and thought, you know what, I enjoyed the play, but I don't understand it. So I thought I'd you know, arrogantly rewrite Shakespeare. So that was the basis of it.
So you're reaching for kind of like Elizabethan, not tropes, but the kind of structure.
Yeah, basically the underlying structure of it was from Coriolanus, but in a way of like taking, I think I got a copy of the play from Gutenberg Press, and I reduced each scene into a sentence.
Yeah.
And then that was my structure, and then I built it back out from that.
I'm going to rewatch the movie now I know that, because I didn't know that, and it did feel familiar to me. I'm not that familiar. I have actually seen Coriolanus live. Do you say live for plays? Is that what you say?
You can do, yeah.
I saw Coriolanus when they toured Hamburg in the 70s. They were an amazing band. But I've seen it, and I just remember thinking, this is kind of ridiculous, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But I didn't draw the parallel. So, but that's, I would have thought, a very useful thing to do when you're screenwriting, especially if you're working and you don't necessarily have the pressure of delivering something, to actually take the structure of something else, because sometimes that must be, I would have thought, quite a hard thing to get in place.
Yeah, and I think that also a lot of those, you know, the Shakespeare plays were, that's how they were made themselves. You know, they weren't, those stories weren't necessarily original stories. They've been taken from older stories or cobbled together from various things from the repertory that was going around. So, yeah, and I wanted to kind of free myself slightly from the tyranny of plot, you know. And I thought, well, let Shakespeare do the plot, and I'll do the dialogue, you know.
And how was it for you then when writing it? Did you feel like there was a less of a burden? Was it an easier and freer experience to put it on the page?
Yeah, I mean, they did once the characters started talking, then they were away. I mean, I think that it does deviate massively from from Coriolanus, obviously, over over the runtime of it. But it was nice to have that, just that, you know, just to destroy the white pages to start with.
I don't remember there being a cross-dresser in Coriolanus.
No, I think that might be a new thing.
So if people are listening are thinking, I'm going to go and see a modern Coriolanus. It really isn't a modern Coriolanus.
No, you want to go and see the Ralph Fiennes one.
Yeah.
That's what you're after.
Do you like working with actors, though? Because actors sometimes, I've met a lot of actors, and I'm fond of almost all of them, but my eyes roll sometimes when I hear about the way they will be with scripts, with directors and so on and so forth. And I know you can't be too relaxed in what you say here, but I wonder whether there are times, do you have methods? Do you have ways of dealing with people?
I love actors, and I think that your life is in their hands, basically. And I think the thing I've learned over the years is that they put themselves, they go to such a vulnerable space. You know, we're all trained from being children to hide our emotions completely and put up so many barriers. You know, and that these people professionally go the opposite way. And I think that for that you forgive any kind of idiosyncratic behavior or difficult behavior, because it's so unnatural to have to kind of do that to yourself, to go on command, to go to being to a very extreme emotional spaces, you know. And for that, you know, if you can make an atmosphere around actors that they will do that for you, then that's cinema, you know. That's the whole thing.
You know, it's why you were saying that. I was reminded of something. A director, a very successful director, and not the kind of director you would think. I won't say his name just in case he doesn't wish to be associated with someone, but he said to me something very interesting, I thought. He said the best actors he'd worked with were the people he thought were genuinely emotionally damaged. And I think he meant that their emotions, therefore, were more readily tapped into.
Yeah, I think it is quite a dangerous thing for them to do, you know, if they go to it too much, and they all have to be quite careful about what roles they take, you know, and certainly one after the other if it goes in a certain direction. So I think that's something it would never occur to me when I started my career that you would see that in people.
I mean, I suppose you're right, being careful to accept the correct role, one which isn't going to adversely affect them. But I would imagine someone who's writing and directing, you presumably, and I know you don't necessarily approach it this way, but I guess you have to be careful. If you finish something like As Dark As Kill List, you know, you don't necessarily want that in your head for much longer than when you've been creating it, or do you?
Yeah, that was very much why I sought out a comedy immediately after Kill List, you know, because it was, making Kill List was so miserable for me and Amy in the edit suite, you know, just dealing with that every day. It's just grim.
But a great film. And I hadn't seen that film when it came out. I came to it after Sightseers.
Oh, right, okay.
So I hadn't seen it before, and I watched it because people had recommended it to me, and I didn't realise it was the same director.
Right.
Which I think is probably a good thing.
Yeah, but it's also kind of the same film.
Yeah.
It's like a couple touring around killing people. That's not too much of a spoiler, is it?
Sightseer is easier to recommend to people, I feel. Don't you think so?
I think it's an entry-level film, you know.
Yeah. But a very, a really impressive, I mean, I know it wasn't your debut, but it was sort of seen as your first film in some ways, wasn't it? I mean, what was the film you made before?
Down Terrace.
Which was obviously a much smaller project.
Yeah.
And didn't get as well received or as widely received. It didn't get seen by as many people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was on at the ICA for a bit. Mm. And it did, I mean, from a standing start, that film was, you know, I had no career and then I had a career. You know, it was one of those moments that, you know, we all got, the team that we got together to do that, we spent 8 days making that film, and it kind of changed all our lives. You know?
8 days, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was quick. I'd spent a lot of time talking about making films and thinking about it and being cross about not making them.
Yeah, but that's interesting. I know a lot of people in that position who never actually get to make one. And the fault is predominantly not theirs, because these days you can make a film, of course. You can't necessarily get it seen, but you can make a film. But what were you doing for? Did you study filmmaking?
No, I was... I've got a fine art degree in sculpture, which has kept me so busy with employment, I can't tell you.
I was going to say, I mean, that's the dream when your kids come home and tell you they're going to study that, isn't it? It's like, well, mum and dad can relax.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't even like a proper skill in terms of carving or something. Or
did it stop?
No, it's conceptual video work, so it was even worse. Yeah.
I mean, I might end this interview now. I'm disgusted.
I would. Yeah, I wouldn't interview me.
What an amazing thing. Why did you...
Well, look, I went to the careers officer at school and he said, what do you want to do? I said, I don't know. He goes, you can do painting and decorating, or you can do, apply for the fire service or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was going out with Amy Jump.
Yeah.
And she's going, I'm going to do a foundation course. I'm like, oh, that sounds all right. Yeah. So I applied for that and I got into that.
Hold it, because you're younger than me, but was this still when you could get a government grant to go?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, this is the key.
Absolutely,
that was the amazing thing.
The door is slammed shut on that now, which is a real horror.
But it's a terrible thing. I think we will feel in the world of, you know, arts like cinema, we are going to suffer from that, because so many great artists and great talents and great creative people wound up going to university while they were figuring out what to do with their life. Because they couldn't. They weren't going to be crippled with debt like they are now.
Yeah.
This is not really sounding like a film podcast right now, is it?
No, it's getting a bit like Daniel Blake, isn't it?
But it was remarkably kind of freeing, wasn't it? And it obviously did create a climate and an atmosphere for creative growth and experimentation.
It was huge. And also being on the Dole as well. So I could kind of rolled out of art school, obviously, straight onto the Dole, because there was somehow the bubble had burst on conceptual sculpture.
Yeah, who knew that was going to happen?
I know. There was no jobs anyway. You know, I remember doing loads of interviews.
Such a solid bet for a while. I haven't seen any of your conceptual work, but I've imagined some of it.
Yeah, for my degree piece, I was beaten senseless by the kickboxing champion of Great Britain.
Well, but literally, not literally beaten senseless.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Literally.
You reenacted.
No, literally.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I figured I was so into film and violent film stuff, but yeah, I'd never not since being at school anyway been beaten unconscious. So I thought let's find out if I'm any good at fighting, even though I like watching fighting.
Did you fight back?
Well, I tried to, but what I found was that even just holding your arms up is quite tiring. Not even punching, just holding them up in front of your face. Yeah. After a while,
especially if someone's whacking them.
Yeah, and he was kicking me and all sorts. Anyway, I always thought that, you know, when you watch a boxing match, you think, why don't you just run around?
Yeah, it's tiring.
It's tiring, and they're really fast. So
they're chasing you.
You see them like that, and then there's a blur, and then you're being punched.
I have been punched in a box. I when I was a kid. Well, I wasn't that young, but when I saw Rocky, I thought, I want to be a boxer.
Mm.
I wasn't even Italian, but it had that effect on me. And I went to one boxing class locally and got punched and fell down straight away. And I thought, no, I don't want to be a boxer.
No.
But it just took one.
No, exactly. Yeah, not the fight out of you. And that, so that was my...
What degree did you get as a result of this act of...
Desmond.
A Desmond degree?
Yeah, 2-2.
A 2-2?
Yeah.
That's what I got. But I didn't have to get beaten up for mine.
Yeah. Yeah, my Amy got a first, of course.
That's irritating, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what was she studying?
Same.
Wow. And what did she do for her final piece?
Oh, something very clever and esoteric. Yeah.
But you weren't bothered by that, I imagine, because it wasn't like that was a step towards something, or it wasn't like you wanted to be a conceptual sculptor.
Yeah, I mean, I basically, when I'd gone to art school, like the first thing they did was take you around all the different departments, and we'd seen like welding and ceramics, and one of the departments was video, and I saw an edit suite.
Of course you would have been attracted to that, yeah.
Yeah, I just went, oh my God, this is me, you know, and then spent the rest of the 3 years with them trying to kick me off the course because I was making narrative
film. Movies, and they didn't want narrative, they wanted pieces of art, stuff.
Yeah.
You knew your way around an edit suite at the end of that 3 years.
Yeah, yeah, that was massively important. Yeah.
And how did you then go about getting finance for the first film? Because that's something which would be useful to people to know, I think, even though I'm sure that...
Well, we just paid for it ourselves.
So you financed it?
Yeah, and it was $6,000.
What did you shoot it on?
On Red One.
So you hired a Red One, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that would have been the main expense then, I guess.
No, what was expensive was putting the actors up in hotels, and because we shot it in Brighton and everyone lived in London, so we had to like get them down from London, put them in a hotel, feed them and stuff. So that ended up being quite expensive. So I think there would have been there's a cheaper version of that film if we'd have been more local or we'd lived in London.
Or bought a tent.
Yeah, bought a tent. Yeah, abused them a bit more. But I think you have to be nice to them when they're doing it for nothing.
You have to be quite nice until you've got the last day in the can.
Yeah,
and then you can send them home and say, no, make your own way. So that was obviously, it was an ambition. And you thought, when you finished it, did you think, okay, I've made, this is what I wanted to be? Or did it fall far short of your expectation? I mean, how much of a kind of a useful process was it just in learning what to do for the next one?
I think that we went into it and we didn't know what it was going to be. and whether it would be any good at all. We didn't have any clue. So we made...
Presumably you hadn't directed actors before.
Oh, no, I'd done TV and ads and all sorts of stuff, yeah.
So you had skill in TV, you had skill in editing, but you hadn't really done narrative stuff in that way.
No, well, this is the thing. It's like the you know, I'd come up from doing stuff online and posting stuff online, and I'd made stuff as the bandwidth got wider. So I'd started with 30 seconds and then done 2 minutes, and then I'd ended up doing sketches for sketch shows.
Right.
So things were like 3 minutes, and then I did like comedy drama, so that's half hour. But all those different disciplines are completely different from each other.
Of course, and so, but each time in a way though, you are edging towards a longer form.
Yeah, and so it was a complete foreign country going into 90 minutes. The rhythms of it are completely different.
The structure's entirely different. I mean, everything's really, the only way you learn to make a film, I guess, is by making a film. Isn't it?
Yeah.
The only way you learn to write a film is by writing a film.
Yeah, well, part of why we made Down Terrace as well was that Rob Hill and I had written it, had written a lot of scripts, spec scripts over the 10 years before, but none of them ever got made. And we figured that we weren't really writers because even though we'd written a lot, we'd never seen it made, so we never knew really if it worked or not. And then we stopped writing kind of American crime scripts, which is what all the other stuff were, and then wrote something that we could actually make.
But I guess that wouldn't necessarily be true, that just because you didn't sell them or get them to the made that they weren't a good example of a script. That wouldn't be the case.
I don't think we could tell whether our theories on writing were true unless we saw them performed. You know, I think that's a big deal for
writers. Have you revisited those scripts? Have you looked at them, or are there elements in them that have appeared in actual finished films?
Yeah, I mean, bits of Free Fire had come out of research that Rob and I had done for a thing called Three Ages of Crime, which in the research for Three Ages of Crime, which was a big anthology crime thing that we'd written, was this piece of FBI report about a shootout that happened in Miami, which was like a procedural report for every bullet fired, every wound, da, 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 da. And from that was the basic kernel for Free Fire.
It's amazing. So that was obviously stayed in your head.
Yeah.
And because was that one of the films, one of the scripts you wrote with that you really wanted to see made? Was that The Three Ages of Crime? Was that something that you had hopes for?
Yeah, I mean, we were big fans of Hawks, and obviously coming out of the Reservoir Dogs and Tarantino's kind of, and John Woo and all that kind of 90s stuff, but going back into the Scorsese stuff, but Hawks primarily, and the Bogart kind of cycle of crime stuff.
So even though you didn't study film, you obviously did study film to an extent, because very few directors of your age will talk about the period before they had any success about Hawks. You know, there aren't that many. I mean, Tarantino, we know he worked in the video store, and we know he obviously immersed himself in film, and other directors as well, but a lot of directors don't, of course. They come up through different routes. So you obviously were, cineast is too grand a word, but you're obviously a major film fan.
Yeah, I watched a lot of movies, consumed as many as I could get my hands on. And it's more so through Rob Hill, who's in Down Terrace and edited and co-wrote it. You know, he had a massive tape collection, and Andy Stark, who's the producer of all the films I've done pretty much except for High Rise, but he do you know Mondo Macabro, which is he's with Pete Toombs, he runs from Mondo Macabro.
Right, right.
So that, but I've known him since I was like 18, 19. Wow. so he gave me access to a lot of kind of quite rare stuff, you know. So that side of it is, and also I think Rob Hill's dad is a massive kind of Bob Hill, who's in Down Terrace, is a massive.
But it's interesting because in a way, then you were steered, even if it wasn't deliberately, you were steered towards slightly more outre stuff, slightly more out there stuff, which is evident in your body of work so far.
Yeah, I think I've always had a kind of very broad film taste, you know, and I watch tentpole movies and Marvel movies and
like them, I'm sure.
But also, you know, art house stuff as much as I can get my hands on. You know.
And so are there movies that you love and you cherish that generally are kind of reviled? Are there films which you have, which would come from that kind of, not video nasty, but that sort of B movie, that sort of extreme cinema, Mondo cinema kind of world that you still cherish?
I think the only film that I find that people are weirdly have a problem with is Zardoz. I don't know why.
I love Zardoz.
Yeah.
I love Zardoz.
Yeah.
It is a terrible, it's a terrible mess.
Yeah, but that's fine as well. You know, and it's a kind of, it's a purely it's a vision of the future which looks like no other, and I think that's kind of what the charm of it is. You know,
I mean, thank God it looks like no other when you see he's Sean Mankini, Connery in that red Mankini, but extraordinary in that. What I love about it, and presumably I think you would like this as well, one of the reasons why you wouldn't get that made today is there's no real logic. There's no real explanation for how things happen. So there's no explanation, for example, how a giant floating stone head can float. And now you would have to have some sort of explanation as to the science.
Quite a long scene, about the aerodynamics.
I've managed to make the stone head fly, it would still be nonsense.
Maybe it'd be like a Zardoz prequel. The building of the stone head.
Tell me that one of your unfinished scripts is either a prequel or sequel to Zardoz.
Well, there is a sequel novel, apparently.
Is there?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know it was based on a novel. Have you read the novel?
No, but I think I'm not sure that Borman didn't write the novel, though.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, but Borman's a very interesting filmmaker.
Yeah.
In the same way that you are, in that he doesn't seem to have a plan. I mean, some of his movies, you know, obviously he'd do some movies, I imagine, for the payday, like Exorcist. Was Exorcist 2 his, The Heretic? I think that was his. And it's the worst Exorcist film by far, I think, even though I love Borman.
Yeah.
But then he'd make kind of wartime dramas later on, as well as hard crime films like Point Blank. That was his, I think.
Point Blank is one of the best films ever made, I think. You know?
Amazing film. Amazing performance by Lee Marvin, of course.
Yeah.
And Angela Lansbury's great in that as well.
Dickinson.
Angela Dickinson.
That's Angela a different
Lansbury,
movie.
I wish Angela Lansbury had been in it. Back in the cupboard, Chip.
Organised crime, she wrote.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave that in just to say, people, that I'm completely fallible. I'm human, and I have fantasies about Angela Lansbury being in hardcore crime thrillers. But it is interesting, isn't it, that there isn't, and there is, sometimes I think, and Scorsese obviously isn't a narrow filmmaker by any means, but still when people think of him, because he made such a splash with films which were very much in the same territory, when people think of Scorsese, they think of those movies very much. Tarantino less so, he's strayed a little bit for it. Someone like Spike Lee, of course, has had a broader range.
Yeah.
Is it deliberate in part by you, even though I've been saying you have no plan, that you don't want to get easily categorised, you don't want to get sort of narrow cast into one kind of filmmaking?
I don't think of it in terms of a body of work, but I do think of it in terms of my own enjoyment of cinema, you know, and I like film, you know, and I don't want to make the same film again and again if I can help it.
Yeah.
And I seek it out, you know, and I'll seek out, I've always wanted to do a rom-com and children's film or light comedy stuff. So those are all things that I'll kind of get to, cowboy movies and war movies and all these things, you know. And it's, and I think you have to, you know, as a filmmaker, the only person who's going to get you those films is yourself. Mm. You know, you have to move towards it. Because if you just basically, if you let the industry do it, you'll just end up making a bigger version of the last film that you made.
But that's one of the things I admire about you is the fact that you make a film like Free Fire, which obviously has a not a huge budget, but a decent-sized budget. Has a great cast, you know, and a cast which must have cost you money as well. But then you're quite happily, it seems to me, moved to a smaller film like Happy New Year, Colin Burstead, which is a great cast again, but a much smaller scale of filmmaking.
Mm.
And I would have thought a much smaller budget and you know, done more on the fly. I would have thought a much kind of quicker shoot than something like that, which doesn't require that much, as much organisation. And so it is for you, I would have thought, the act of filmmaking itself, the creating a movie, is the buzz rather than being, you know, invited to Cannes and being, you know, a Hollywood director.
Yeah, well, I think they're the Hollywood director and Cannes are two separate things, aren't they? But I think the you know, if you look at rock and roll or something, the throwing ink of tellies out of windows and all that kind of behaviour is not writing music, is it? You know, the bits that go around the filmmaking are as interesting as making movies. That's the, you know, that's the thing I want to do, and making stories and drama.
And at what stage in the movie making process are you most enjoying it? Is it the writing when it's just you and maybe Amy or you and someone else? Is it the shooting when you're working directors, or is it the edit when you're kind of alone with the finished works and you're then trying to make it work in the way you want it to?
I like editing a lot because I was an editor to start with, and it's you're much more in control and there's less time pressure stuff. But I over time, I used to not like the shooting as much as the rest of it, but I've grown to really love being on the floor and doing it.
You look like an editor.
Do I? And what the fuck does that mean?
I mean, you look relaxed in a working environment. if you look at Ben's IMDb page, there's a picture of you where you look like, I don't know, you look like you're going to be a thug in one of your movies there. It's just the short hair.
Well, what it is is that I'm really stressed in the middle of shooting Down Terrace.
Is that what it says? It's a very early picture.
Yeah, yeah. And basically, after that, they put in a charge in IMDb for updating your photograph. And I'm so cheap, I never change.
If you want the picture changed.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So it's stuck, that one, yeah.
Let's talk about Sightseers a bit, because I think Sightseers is an amazing film. It's an amazing film, genuinely amazing. I think it's a great script. It was you and Amy on the script, wasn't it?
Amy did a rewrite on it, but it was originally Alison Steve's.
So Alison Steve, who's starring it as well.
Yeah.
Remarkable performances.
Yeah.
Wonderful performances. And then Amy rewrote it with you, or?
No, she did it on her Todd, yeah.
But just a great script, great film. And really unexpected, I think. I mean, you start watching, you think, okay, this is kind of nuts in May.
Mm.
And then it goes gonzo. Financing something like that, is it harder because it goes in that unexpected swerve, or is that what people loved about it? I mean, how do you go about getting money for a film?
I came on it reasonably late. You know, I think it was a short film originally that Paul King had shot.
Oh, really?
And then Edgar Wright was involved in it, and he was pushing it through Big Talk. And I think it had gone on for a good few years, you know, bouncing backwards and forwards between the financiers and Big Talk and, you know, but basically looking for a director. And then I got called into the offices there, and they said, oh, are you interested in this? And I basically agreed to do it on the spot without reading it.
Was that because they'd seen Kill List that they thought you were a good fit for it?
Down Terrace they'd seen.
So Down Terrace, that's interesting. Because Kill List is a closer film in some ways.
Yeah, but I don't think Kill List was finished by that point.
I see.
So that was, because it's all, if you look at the dates, they're all like one after the other each year. So, and I kind of went, I'd worked with Alice and Steve before on BBC comedy stuff, so I knew them pretty well. And I'd had a long chat with Alice, I think, a year or so before, when she was on the Coogan tour when I was doing Ideal, the Johnny Vegas show.
Well, she's directed now as well, of course.
Yeah, Prevenge, which is excellent.
Which was great. And Steve, I can't remember the name of the film. You'll remember the film with the angel.
Oh, what don't film know that. Was it? He directed the one with everyone talking in monkey voices. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that. That's
called Ah.
Well, it sounds like it should be top of the list for anyone, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a Rook film as well. We were one of the producers on
it. Have you not seen the film where he plays a kind of, not a Satanist, but a kind of occultist who helps a woman who's going through bereavement to try and summon an angel so she can speak to her dead son? Oh, it's right up your street.
Sounds like a dream you've had after eating cheese.
Maybe I imagined it. I think I saw it at a cinema. And do you eat, by the way, do you eat sweets when you go to the cinema? Do you eat a lot of sweets?
No, never, no.
Okay. It's a weak spot, and sometimes my wife and I, and we're quite old people.
Mm.
We still have no self-control. When we went to see Baby Driver, we ate so many sweets that I thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to have a heart attack during the movie. And in the end, she had to help me into the car.
Recently, we were watching this thing of on Netflix about cooking, and there was this woman was going, you've got to put salt all over steaks. You've got to put salt all over steaks. I'm like, I've never done that in my life. That's weird. So I got all these really nice steaks and covered them in salt. And they were really salty. They were horrible, you know. And we were both, Amy and I sat there and were like, oh my God, we might actually die from this. And our hearts were racing. Yeah, all
right. I'm thrilled we're not the only couple of those kind of conversations. And yeah, and you're not young either. You should know better as well.
Well, I felt tricked.
Yeah.
It was, you know.
You have an excuse. I have no excuse. Because every time I go to the cinema, I'll do it again. I'll say, why do we keep doing this? It's a bad thing. But it's interesting you mentioned Edgar. You mentioned Paul King there. Because in a way, the three of you, you are three young British directors in love with cinema.
Youngish.
Young from where I'm sitting, you'll be pleased to know. And all have, you know, very successful careers now. But in some ways, I would have thought you are all outside of any kind of studio system. And maybe I wonder whether you could only happen here in the UK. It's the kind of place where you get that chance to do TV. Paul, of course, Edgar from Space. Paul did Boosh.
Yeah.
And then for Paul King to go from the Mighty Boosh to Paddington is such an absurd thing. I mean, if you'd have told me in advance that he would be the right director for Paddington and that Paddington had flavours of that which would benefit it, I would have thought that it was a crazy thing to say. And yet it works magnificently well. Both those films are incredible.
Yeah, I wouldn't have said that was such a leap. I mean, I think that the design and the care that's in the Boosh TV series, it makes an easy translation
the
into
kind
that
of children's shows is what you said.
Very beautifully rendered artistic visions.
But they are kind of extreme kind of adult versions of crazy children's shows. You know?
Yeah, but your other one would be Burton from Pee-wee's to
Yes, Tim Burton as well. But he didn't fit my the point I was trying to make, which is that we have this kind of English culture.
Yeah.
And here you've got Edgar coming from space. You've got you coming from, you know, one thing you mentioned, Vic Reeves, loosely, but other kind of TV comedy. And then stumbling into cinema or making your way into cinema and making movies which are still peculiar. They're still very much your voices.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting about the three of you, I think. Even when there's a bigger budget at play, it's still very clearly one of your films. And I wonder whether, or wonder how that is.
Well, I don't know about Paul so much, but I think if you follow this thread with Edgar and with Peter Strickland and Joanna Hogg as well, to a degree, but it's everyone's kind of come, they've made films that are self-financed, basically, first up. You know, and they, and come through the industry from a position of putting themselves through it and make you know going I'm going to be a filmmaker and I'm going to do it myself. You know,
really wanting it.
Yeah,
really wanting it to the point where and yeah, you're right. They're not wanting it for the wrong reasons. If that's an okay thing to say, you know.
I don't know if it, I think it's like not waiting and not going and thinking it about how you get into the industry in a tangential way, not in a kind of received way of going. Oh, I'm going to apply for this and then I'm going to move through this and make my way up through various gatekeepers to be given work, you know. And I think that there's, you know, I end up talking to a lot of like young directors and people coming up through the industry, and that's kind of the thing I try and tell them the most, that the way through it is not there is no fair way through it, and you have to force your way through it, but you'll be better for it, because at the end of the day, if you've made your own stuff and it's gone well, then no one can really tell you.
And you can then go, but even in a way, if you make yourself and it hasn't gone well,
yeah,
you've done it and you know how to do it.
But this kind of circles round to kind of me watching stuff like Incredibly Strange Picture Show and seeing things like the Within the Woods, you know, the
Sam Raimi film.
Yeah,
well, I didn't know you'd seen that as well, because I know Edgar Wright credits that with him thinking that was the first time he realised this was. By the way, I should just put this was a show, a documentary series I made for Channel 4 in 1988, and then 1989, and one of them was Sam Raimi. And I'd loved...
And there's a big Romero one as well, isn't there?
Big Romero one, which I directed, bizarrely.
Right.
Very badly. And then I get credit on directing another one. I get credit on directing the Russ Meyer one, only because Russ Meyer had fallen out with the director.
Right.
And he wouldn't have him on the set. So he told me where to put the cameras for what he wanted, and we had to pretend I was directing it, because Russ was crazy. But anyway, I did this show, Incredibly Strange Film Show, and the Sam Raimi thing, Edgar said he saw that, and was the first time he realised, and he was... probably wherever he lived near Glastonbury when he was a kid, I suppose it would have felt like the film industry was just, you know, an unattainable kingdom elsewhere that you'd never get to. But he saw this and realized these guys had raised the finance by going around to family members and local businessmen. A dentist gave him quite a lot of money and had just done it themselves.
Yeah.
And it had, and so you saw that as well.
Yeah, I saw that, and it made a massive impression, you know, that idea that you don't need any connection to the film industry to force your way into it, kind of thing, and to make and that people were just excited about cinema outside of the system themselves, you know. So yeah, that and Movie Drome, I think those are the two shows that were
Alex Cox's Movie Drome, which was great. Interestingly, you know, I would imagine, and I don't know how many younger people will be listening to this, I imagine there's some, but I suspect they don't see it in the same way, because with the advancing technology, with the fact that you can quite legitimately, if you wish to, shoot a whole movie on a phone now.
Yeah,
you know, you have access to that, and you don't necessarily need what was seen as needed. But then, like, you had to hire a camera, and obviously, you still want. But you can even get a movie shot on an iPhone released, can't you? Didn't Soderbergh do one?
I think there's a whole like subgenre of stuff that's shot. But I think it matters. It's, you know, it hasn't mattered since Blair Witch, really, or even A Night of the Living Dead. You know, which is.
But it's interesting because Blair Witch made a feature of the lower technology they were using.
Sure,
it was meant to be shot. That was, of course, Night of the Living Dead didn't. It was like meant to be a kind of a proper movie, and it was a proper movie.
Yeah, but it's still in that. It's still in the vocabulary of like news footage. Gritty,
What did you shoot the new film on? Colin Burstead. What did you shoot that on?
That's on an Arri Alexa.
So it's a smaller unit then.
Well, no, it's the same cameras we shot the last two films on, but
it's got a different look. It's got a very, it's very fluid camera work.
I mean, it's shot like a documentary, you know. Yeah, yeah. So it's shot like a documentary, and it's two camera most of the time, and you know, shot out in 10 days. So it's quick, you know. But I really like working like that as well, and I never see that as a kind of a. I don't going from budget to budget. I never see it as a step up or a step down, as long as the script is written to fit the budget. if it's an expensive script you're shooting for not much money, then that's when the horror starts, you know.
When you're writing though, do you ever write with budget in mind? Do you ever think, okay, I'm going to deliberately keep the budget down here because I know, realistically, it is going to be easier to get this made?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And so what kind of corners did you cut? For example, in Free Fire, did you cut any corners in there? Because that, would I be right thinking that's probably your most expensive film today?
I think it's the same budget as High Rise was, actually.
Right. Oh, no, of course, High Rise.
Yeah.
But you can kind of, yeah, you can see both of them. You can see the money that's been spent on screen.
Yeah.
You know, and they both need that, of course. But did you have to cut corners? Did you still think, okay, maybe we won't do it quite... I guess Free Fire, you know it's going to be limited in that locale because that's the whole point. High Rise, similar in a way, but grander in scale.
Yeah, I mean, High Rise was more complicated, that's for sure. And it's a lot of locations and a lot of moves around, and we had to think on our feet about how we did it. You know, there's only, there's many, many apartments in the block, but there's only one apartment set.
Yeah.
So it was just repainted a lot. And,
oh, really? So yeah. You just used the set again and again?
Yeah, and sometimes we did it, reversed it, so we flipped the image. And then printed all the labels backwards.
It worked though. I didn't notice that at all. And often I do in films, especially low budget movies or lower budget films, where you see and you think, okay, they've just put that bed against the radiator.
Yeah.
And now they're trying to pretend it's a different apartment. But yeah. I saw that radiator earlier. I know I did. I'd recognize that radiator.
I have a trace memory of this radiator. Yeah.
And that's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Fighting against. Now, High Rise didn't do that well financially. Did it? Didn't do that well commercially.
Oh, it did all right. Yeah.
When I looked at the figures, I expected it to be a much bigger film than it was.
Yeah.
Have I just broken some news to you that you did? Have I just said something which is completely
inappropriate? I just bought a yacht, and now I don't know how I'm going to pay it off.
I hope it's not a big yacht. At the time, though, I thought, okay, I'm so thrilled you're making this, but it's kind of, it's almost an act of foolishness because the novel is so extreme. Like most of that stuff. You know it's going to be, I knew it would be a great film. I knew it would be a great story well told, but I also knew it would be a story that wasn't for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it didn't do Harry Potter money, that's for sure. But it did, I think it did okay in its theatrical run in the UK. It did nothing in the States. It was like,
And was that a disappointment for you, or did you not expect it to do well over there? I mean, I don't know how heavily invested you are in how well things do.
Well, I guess you can be disappointed that each time you do it, there's a chance it could be massive.
Yeah.
So you do have a bit of a grieving moment for the massive version of it that never happened. You go, that would have been really helpful if that had been really big. But
I'm not asking you to blame them, but do you think, okay, was this film, could that film have been better marketed, for example? Because if you know what you're getting when you go and see High Rise, I knew what I was expecting and you delivered it.
Yeah.
So I was satisfied, fully satisfied. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I didn't think you'd missed it. You know what I mean? So it wasn't, I'm not saying in any way I thought it was a failure, is what I'm saying here. Whereas I imagine that if you had gone expecting a different kind of movie, if it had been marketed differently, which I know some films do fail because of the way they're sold to an audience.
I think it was, in the UK, it was pretty fairly marketed. It was, the trailer was saying, it was, you know, and they certainly could have leaned into the Hiddlestonness of it more and then gone.
Because by then he'd become a big star.
Well, Night Manager had come out that week, I think, as well. So it was like full peak Hiddleston at that point.
Peak Hiddleston. I love Hiddleston.
But I don't know. I mean, I think you're right. It's like if you're making a Ballard adaptation, it's like you can't, there's no point tricking people to go.
No, because word of mouth is going to kill it afterwards. If you go along expecting, I don't know, Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
Bad example. Because
that's a weird example.
I was trying to think of something, because I was thinking of something set in an apartment block and that last Judge Dredd film, which was good.
Yeah.
The second one. But unfortunately...
Well, it's a trilogy of Dredd, The Raid and High Rise, isn't it?
The Raid, of course, was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. We were at Toronto for Midnight Madness with Kill List, and The Raid was on part of Midnight Madness. And they have like a... audience vote for their favourite film. So, and we got tricked somehow into going. Me and Andy Stark went to the lunch where they announced the winners, right? So there was 10 films in Midnight Madness, and they counted down from 8, and The Raid won.
Yeah,
but we weren't in any of them. So the countdown from 8 was just horrific. We're like, oh, why did you with the, you know, the 9th most popular or 10th most popular film out of 10, and you asked to see it, you know?
Anyway. I was the 11th most popular. I didn't even make a film. I mean, and I was there. But presumably, you don't carry that with you. You made the movie you wanted to make. You made the best movie you could with the budget, time, and with the script that you'd written. You know, that was the film you wanted to see.
Amy'd written, yeah.
So you could, but did you write? You had it with Amy?
No.
I keep saying that.
That's the thing. It's like it's that I kind of take blanket credit for all these scripts when I haven't written hardly any of them.
Directors.
Yeah, it's a kind of form of osmosis.
I think, you know, it's not unsurprising in a way, though, because there must be elements you add to the script. There must be things you change. You don't want to say that.
Well, no, I mean, on High Rise and Field in England, the very, you know, basically what happened on those movies and going into Free Fire was that we started to really question the credit of the directing auteur credit, you know. Yeah. And it's kind of those films are co-made. You know, co-created. They're not. You know, and is the director more important than the writer editor, which Amy is?
But it's really interesting. TV, of course, it seems to be that the writers, but only the writers at the very top, but the writers get more credit than the director.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in film, it's completely the opposite. In film, people don't even know, as I've just proven, don't often know who's written the script, who should get the credit for the script.
Yeah, yeah. It's a different. It's certainly a different hierarchy there. So yeah, I mean, I think in the end, in High Rise and in Free Fire, the directing and writing credits are on the same card. Like contractually, usually it's the director credit on its own first, and then the writers. But with Amy, we both share it because we're cutting it together as well.
And because so you live with Amy.
Yeah.
You write with Amy sometimes.
Well, not in the kind of death trap style two typewriters throwing words across the room kind of way.
So she writes a draft and you throw some stuff in afterwards? Is that how it works?
More the other way around. So I'll write, if we're writing together, I'll write something and then she'll rewrite it.
And then she's on the set and you're in the editing process together, which sounds, to be honest with you, I mean, you know, that sounds like that's a tough thing for a relationship to survive, to be honest with you.
It sounds a bit like maybe what the Coens do though, isn't it? To a degree.
Yeah, but then last time I checked, they don't sleep together. I don't get too personal with you.
But they're very related.
Yeah, but that's what I'm getting at. It's like, at the end of the night, if they've had a bit of a tense moment in the edit suite, they've got someone else to spoon.
True that. But what it is with
and
us...
And you're going home and you're sleeping on separate sides of the bed. Furious, simmering, resentment, rage, froideur.
What we have is a loft bit of the house, and that's where the editing happens. And then whatever happens there...
Well, I thought you said that's where I sleep.
That's where I sleep, yeah. That's where the editing happens. And when we go downstairs, we don't talk about what's happened in the loft.
So you basically, what happens in the loft stays in the loft.
Stays in the loft. So a lot of shouting. It's very aggressive, you know, from me mainly. But
I think there's a film in there based on the couple who take over your house. And then they say, the whole house is lovely, but there's a strange atmosphere in the loft.
It's tense up
there. And they have to get an exorcist in to exorcise the legacy of filmmaking that went on in this
time. Yeah, well, we moved a few years ago, but there's a house in Brighton where Kill List and Field in England and all these films were edited.
That would not be my first choice of house to live in. Let's talk about Field in England a little bit, because it's a remarkable film. Such a peculiar story, such a peculiar idea. But when you see it, I remember thinking, oh, why has no one done this before?
Mm.
Why has no one put this element in this kind of period before? And so when you wrote it, did you think, oh, we've stumbled on something great here, we've come up with a great idea? Were you confident that it would feel as fresh and as unique as it did?
Again, it was just following a thread. You know, I'd wanted to do something about the English Civil War, or the two Civil Wars, and that had been going on for like 10, 15 years. And I'd gone to Memmingen in Germany to this battle reenactment festival thing that they have there, and dressed up in the gear and did the whole nine yards. And
I think we might want to return to that.
Yeah, living history and all.
Is that LARPing?
No, this is proper, you know, the sealed
knot. Historical reenactment.
Yeah. Proper reenactment. So I was there and drinking mead and eating off a spit roast and all this kind of stuff. It was absolutely brilliant. And I was doing a documentary about it, but I never did anything.
So you've got the footage?
Yeah, I found it the other day, yeah, actually. And it's really moody, you know, like Memmingen itself is like a medieval town in the centre of it. So, and when everyone goes home, it's just everyone's staggering around in their in their outfits.
That must be amazing.
It's amazing, yeah.
I want to go. But would I be right in thinking that there was an element, even though it's a very different kind of movie and I'm not comparing it at all, but growing up, I'm sure you loved the Hammer films.
Yeah.
I'm sure you loved Witchfinder General. There's that feeling, it kind of feeds into that, kind of informs it.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that, but maybe it's only because there's only about three films made about the Civil War,
yeah,
you know, around that period, and it's that and Win Stanley. Mm. We looked at, even though it's not the same period, but we looked at Culloden as well.
Yeah, but we feel it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then to throw the kind of the weird drug element in, was the masterstroke, I felt.
Yeah, well, it had come from research. I mean, it wasn't a kind of, you know, the modern world forcing its way into an historical film. It was something we'd read, and Amy had done read this thing about people who were weird folk who would go around and they'd grind up mushrooms and blow them into people's faces.
It's amazing.
And then they would be having these visions, not knowing why. And then there's all this stuff about Argot and the bread that gets basically gets mold on it and then becomes LSD, and people having these religious visions because they're eating.
Because the theory is that the idea of witches flying was based on hallucinogenics.
Yeah.
And wise women were accused of having powers because they would be using the weirder herbs available.
Yeah, or they'd just make a load of bread and everyone would have these massive intense trips, and that's obviously the only reason that could have happened, not because the bread was poisoned. No,
because the witch steered you.
Yeah, and so that was it. And then another thing Amy found was about the mushroom circles, and that there's this idea that if you go inside a mushroom circle, it has a different time zone inside it, and the only way to get out of that time zone is by four men pulling you out on a rope.
Amazing.
So we read that one. Wow, that's brilliant. That's going in.
Yeah, yeah. Shot in black and white, though. Why black and white for that?
Didn't have colour in the past.
You see, that's exactly the kind of in-depth film chit-chat people are hoping for.
Well, what it was
made before colour. Then why has it got sound, Ben? Answer me that.
They had sound in the past. But it was partially as banal as that, but it was, some of it was...
So you wanted to have a slightly... disconnected feel from the modern world.
It was to do with the when you shoot in black and white, everything's about texture and not about the color of things. So yeah, the sky and the ground become the same, and then it becomes about the cragginess of people's faces and the their clothes having
see those details.
Creases.
Yeah. Which in a way though is relevant for as I understand it, and I've never taken hallucinogenics. Or indeed eaten overly mouldy bread. So, but you do see those details more. They take on life of their own, I believe. So was that partly that? You were hoping that people would have a trippy feel to it?
Yeah, it become super intense as part of, and it was shot on very high definition. And then in the in air quotes, trip sequence stuff was designed to try and make it feel physiologically like it might feel if you were taking drugs.
Kind of divided critics somewhat, though. I mean, most people I saw liked it very much indeed, but the people who didn't like it really didn't like it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I think most of the reviews were pretty good, pretty solid. No, there was a few naysayers.
And do you have a thick enough skin not to let that trouble you, or do you take that on board ever, or does it bother you?
No, well, it's complicated because what worries me often with reviews is that it can affect going forward on the next project sometimes.
So getting finance, getting the next one.
But whether or not it's, I was thinking about this the other day that I usually read all the reviews. I don't think there's anybody that would read every single, like so many reviews on one film. So I get kind of quite an in-depth understanding of what
the scale of the thing,
Yeah. And most of them go from any one number of the films I've made being the worst film ever made by anyone ever, to a really great film that they really, really liked. And as long as you've got that spectrum of reviews, it's fine. Yeah. If they were all sitting in one bit, like saying it was awful, then I might start to go, Christ, maybe I've made a horrible mistake here. But generally, it's all... And that's the internet. That's what it's like. It's like it's every opinion all the time.
Every opinion all the time. So you're obviously going to hit a lot of negativity, but a lot of positivity as well. But it's interesting that you open yourself to that, because a lot of people avoid that. And I can see the sanity. I can see the reason for avoiding.
Yeah, I think it's dangerous. Yeah, and you get sucked into it, and it becomes, it's an ego trap. It's terrible.
Have you ever posted under an alias about one of your movies on a site when someone's got it terribly wrong?
No, because it's too easy to see through that with technology,
and you will get caught. So that's the reason. So you would get caught.
Yeah, I thought about it. Yeah, for sure.
Someone misses a point.
Yeah.
Basically, it must be infuriating.
Yeah, but that's,
I mean, it's on them, of course, but I just wonder whether you felt like wading in.
Well, you do sometimes, but I think it's that you've got to just stop for a moment and think of what this looks like from the outside world, which is, shouting into the wind, basically.
Also, you're making the movies you want to make, so you're already doing that. You don't need to trouble yourself. And I'm wondering, when they're done, of course, so you can't change them, even if you wanted to. Is it easy to separate yourself from after the event? Is it easy to walk away and say, okay, well, that was then and this is now? And
yeah, I think I think that it's like photographs of that you take over time and you look at them back and you go, I don't remember that person particularly. And even in the short amount of time that these films have been made, I'd look back and I think I've changed so much from movie to movie. I see them as completely separate things. I don't I don't think if I made them today, I'd make them completely differently. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean I want to change what I've made.
No.
But I think that though it's a very unique set of circumstances of characters, people coming together to make these things. You know, and a lot. You know, I think about filmmaking in those terms of like of making an environment and an emotion on the day and capturing that emotion and that is really mercurial and weird and hard to put your finger on. You know, so. And it's, yeah, and I remember I'd watched, went to America and showed Kill List at a university and I watched it and hadn't watched it for years and I thought, God, this is really mean, this film, and I can't quite believe how cruel and mean it is.
It's dark. So.
Yeah, yeah, and that was a bit of a shock, you know, but it's...
So you'd forgotten?
Yeah, and I just, because often I watch them intensely, obviously, every day for months as we edit them.
In the edit as well, yeah. You're living every scene.
Yeah, but then once it's out, you go to the premiere, and I don't really watch them again.
Are there times though when you, because presumably there must be stuff that you just can't put in. It's time as much as anything, or it takes the film in a different direction. There must be scenes from some of these films that you do. You ever think, how would that have played if we left that in? Were there moments which would soften the harshness of Kill List that you remove from it, or was it always going to be brutal?
I don't know. I mean, I think that you know, you can't really double guess that stuff. It's just what it is, you know, and that's why I tend not to put like deleted scenes on discs, because I think it's a bit of a cheat. You know, you don't want to really enjoy a film and then go, oh look, there's all this shit that
you
put
say
in.
That, but listen, Ben, here, I know you're going to agree with me on this. I do agree with you. But we were talking before we sat down the chat about a movie we both adore, which is in my opinion perhaps as well unfairly reviled, which is David Lynch's Dune, or Dune if you're an American.
Yeah.
Right. And I went to see that the night it opened and didn't care for it. But then I felt compelled to go back and see it like 2 days later while it was still showing at the Empire Leicester Square, I think.
Big screen. Wow, big, yeah. And was it 60 mil as well?
It was 60 mil, but yeah. The worst thing about it was, though, at that level, because the special effects weren't very good, and I don't know whether DeLaurentis was saving money at the end or what was going on, but it had matte lines. There were kind of blue lines around the spice worm that you could have probably driven a bus through. I mean, they were on a big screen. You saw every technical flaw or every kind of like, you know, the clumsiness of technology back then was blown up last year, so it did undermine it somewhat.
Right.
And they weren't great special effects, I think. But you know, the physical effects that Lynch created were amazing. But the actual kind of like what would have been Industrial Light and Magic or whoever did it, they weren't good. But I've grown to love that movie, and I've got about four or five versions of it. It's Japanese release, American release, there's the Alan Smithy release that they took his name off and did for TV with the terrible X. Have you seen the one with the drawings?
No, I don't even know about that.
Oh, there's one where they put drawings at the beginning to try and explain to people what's going to happen.
Right.
And they're some of the worst drawings you've seen in your life. However, I love all those versions. And of course, you would have seen the deleted scenes from that, I'm sure, haven't you?
No.
But the deleted scenes, so it doesn't spoil my love of the movie.
Right,
but
right.
There's some great scenes that Lynch was forced to cut out, perhaps, or cut out himself. Which are there, I've probably got them here in this office. Amazing.
Right, right.
And so I'm thrilled as a fan of that film that I can see those things, those moments, even though, of course, they were cut out. And they don't really, the movie isn't better, any better or worse without them.
Yeah.
It just is what it is.
I can see that. I mean, for me, it's more like not showing how the sausage is made. And you don't want to, the other thing we don't do is we don't share the scripts out. So there's no scripts available for any of our films, you know, and Amy's very particular about that. She doesn't want anyone to see it.
Why?
She just doesn't want him to know, because it's the mystery of the thing. You don't want him to. You don't want him to come behind the curtain and see how the thing's made, because that's the experience. You start.
So you want the pure cinematic experience.
Yeah, you once you start picking at it and like working out how it's done, the thing I always think about is when I, you know, watch Doctor Who, and they used to do that. What's it, Doctor Who Uncovered? And it was like immediately afterwards, and they're all there, you know, having a fag with the tops of their heads off and stuff, and it ruins it.
Does,
it, you know?
It pulls away from the magic, but more so in TV than film, I think. I mean, because I don't think people. I mean, for example, if there must be outtakes from Free Fire, right?
Yeah, there's hours of it.
Right, I'm sure I would enjoy seeing some of them.
Yeah, but you know, I selected the specific ones for the film.
But
it wouldn't
spoil the film. The film would still be there.
Yeah, I mean, maybe in 10 years' time when I'm just a bit more relaxed.
Yeah.
Then I'll let some of that stuff out. But
I mean, as you know, I'm a big Hiddleston fan.
Mm.
There must be some moments of Hiddleston that you've held back.
I could do you like a reel.
I mean, you know what? I would love that, but I can't be trusted. But I would like to see you given the chance to play with a huge budget.
Mm.
And I suspect you would quite like that as well.
Yeah, I think to have the canvas is amazing, and it's also just as a film fan to see the, you know, as moving through different genres and stuff, but also there's genres of budget that give you, you know, and it'll give you access to larger audiences as well.
But the actors you work with, you've been very good, I think. You're very smart at selecting actors. You've selected great actors to work with. And as we were talking about the new film, when we were talking about Neil in it, and Neil doesn't get as much work as I think he should. I mean, I know he is working, but he's a tremendous actor, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm thrilled that he gets the chance to work with you. So it's not like an actor thing. I don't think I want to see you working with stars per se, or people who we see as stars, but I want to see you working, I want to see a bigger Ben Wheatley world on screen. And I kind of had that with High Rise. You kind of create that with High Rise, but obviously you were working fiercely within the confines of what you could afford. So if you had a bigger budget, what genre, you've mentioned various genres you'd quite like to explore, like the Western. I imagine a big sci-fi thing would be something to build. Would you be interested in superhero? Is there something else that demands a bigger budget that you'd like to work with?
Well, you know, I think superhero is tricky, isn't it? Because it's they've been largely mined, you know. And I'm a comics fan and collected comics since I was a kid, and was thrilled when it all started kicking off and there was, you know, it was coming to the screen and stuff. But I can't, you know, it's getting harder and harder to see what would be new, you know, and what would be different from what they've done.
I'm trying to think of a film, and it was directed by a guy called Josh Trank, and it's called Chronicle or something
And he did Fantastic Four, didn't he?
Yeah, and Fantastic Four wasn't good. His Fantastic Four wasn't good. But his Chronicle was very good, I thought. And that was a very different take, but once again, it was a low-budget take on superhero. So if you had the big budget, or is there a script you've written that would require a big budget? Is there an area that you would leap to if you were given the chance?
Yeah, I think I'd love to do a sci-fi thing.
So a big sci-fi?
Yeah, something with a completely controlled world, you know, that would be ace.
And have you written one?
Well, we were trying to get this thing called Freak Shift made for the last 5-6 years, which is the storyboards by Mick McMahon.
Oh, really? I know Mick McMahon stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that
he was 2000 AD, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, he's like the Judge Dredd artist.
Yeah, great artist.
Yeah, yeah. And he's just brilliant. So, and Slane he did and all that stuff. Anyway,
Slane was incredible. Slane will make a great film as well.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know where you get someone that... It's the physicalness of Slane is hard, isn't
Hiddleston.
It? I reckon. If we could get his hair spiky enough.
Poor Tom. We like Tom. We're not knocking Tom here. I'm just reaching.
He only lives up the road. He'll come down and punch you if you're not careful. You know?
Yeah, that's going to be my thesis film. Me being beaten senseless. It's my conceptual sculpture word there. You know what you're doing next, don't you?
Next, I'm doing 2 episodes of Strange Angel.
What's that? I don't know.
It's a TV show. It's a brilliant story about a true story about a rocket scientist who's also a Satanist.
So it's based on a true story?
Yeah.
And how does the Satanist inform the rocket science side of life?
Well, he gets involved in kind of a cult in LA. Wow. Just before the war.
And so that sounds amazing. So you're doing 2 episodes of that, but cinema-wise...
And then roll off out of that into a big kind of romantic feature, hopefully.
It's kind of a gothic period thing, I believe.
Yeah.
Can I say that?
Yes.
Okay, so that will be great. And that will be, without asking specifics, do you have a large enough budget to create some of that in the way that you would want to?
Absolutely, yeah.
So that's going to be, so it's probably quite a different thing in some ways, a different filmmaking experience.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, every one of them has been 90 degrees to the next. So, yeah. And I've kind of sought this out specifically to be very different from everything else I've done so far.
And then you're doing an episode of Mrs. Brown's Boys, I believe.
Definitely.
I'd quite like to see that. I mean, I know it's not going to happen. But, you know, I'm just thinking about the weird, not weird, but it is the unexpected. And I can see why. But the unexpected turns you make. And it's kind of as much to keep yourself interested or challenge yourself, I guess.
Yeah, and sometimes it's the fanboyish stuff. You know, so I ended up doing Doctor Who. You know, I kind of just wanted to do it, I got to go on the TARDIS and blah blah Dalek and all that stuff. And
it's a great fun thing to do.
It was amazing. My son was 10 at the time as well, so it was.
And was Doctor Who your favourite when you were his age?
Gotcha, yeah, massive Who.
Favourite Doctor?
Baker.
Yeah.
Come on, what's that? What's that face?
I'll tell you why. I would have been all over Baker.
Yeah.
But I thought Tennant did such an amazing job. And the scripts were great in
that period.
I think that was the best period for Doctor Who scripts, the Tennant period.
I think they're good, but...
When Russell T Davies first took it over, though, that first season with Chris and with Billy Piper was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
But there's something to be said about the 70s and 80s Who, that long, like 9 episodes. It's like you have a whole episode of them trying to open a door or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Or just being afraid, you know, and I love all that. Or like whole like shooting in nuclear power stations, which
but
they
ben,
did quite
that's
a lot.
Because we had nothing else to do back then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was either that or Credo.
It was either that or Credo, or a long walk.
Yeah, yeah.
That was it. Credo, yes. Sunday TV, Saturday TV.
Yeah, or a walk down to the news agent and it was closed. Yeah. That was Sunday, yeah.
That was Sunday.
Yeah.
And that was a good Sunday when you went down there, when you were allowed to go out for a walk. So, well, continued success. I'm enjoying your career very much, you know, from the sidelines. I love seeing what you're going to do next. I wish I'd been able to follow it from day one, because I feel I came to it late, unfortunately, whereas Edgar's stuff I saw from his very first movie onwards.
Right.
And I saw him changing, growing that way.
What, Fistful of Fingers you saw first?
I saw Fistful of Fingers, yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Because I vaguely knew Edgar, because I knew Peg a little bit.
Right.
The guys back then. I mean, Edgar came round once or twice to watch movies with Joe and Adam.
Right.
You know, so it was very early period. And he's, you know, improved amazingly, of course. He's changed drastically as a filmmaker. His style is too consistent. You don't have the same consistency of style, though, of course. Mm. And that, one thing that strikes me is kind of like, it's one of the things I like about you, but it's also peculiar.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think that I think that the approach I've always had with stuff is to emotionally respond to what I'm seeing in the room, you know, so as much as anything. So that
the way the movie and the situation dictates how you shoot it.
Yeah. And that there's a reaction by the camera to the performance. And so sometimes that's the choice of being stuff being gripped or stuff being handheld or whatever. So, and that kind of makes for very different films, you know.
So Happy New Year, Colin Burstead is out now, and it's very different to all of Ben's other films. I mean, I kind of do know it's one of your films. This is it's quite a hard thing to pin down as to what it is that makes it one of them, because I think you would probably be able to guess, and I don't know whether it's because you do get right in there amongst it with them, and you are clearly responding to it. But once again, it doesn't have the same sort of camera moves. It's not edited in the same way as some of the other films.
Mm.
And obviously, thematically, and in terms of the actual content, it's very different. But it's clearly one of your films. And I think it's a very fine piece of work. It's very enjoyable. It's very different. And it's funny and dark.
Oh, cool. Thanks,
and
man.
Some great performances. In particular, Charles Dance, obviously.
Well, he's the dancer. Fantastic.
The dancer. Script-wise, I guess, are you already working? We know we're doing the Gothic Romance. But are you already working, or do you already have in place the ideas that you're trying to raise funding for after that?
Yeah.
That'll tell you, you'll be a year on this next
year. Yeah, I'll be, come out the other side in 2020, I think. But yeah, there's stuff kicking about. I'm writing all the time, so writing TV stuff as well.
So. And so when do you write? How does the day, so you write when you're not actually on set directing or actually editing, I guess?
Yeah, but I'm not, I mean, that editing and directing doesn't take up a massive amount, proportion of the year, usually, you know, so... Yeah, so I just pot around the house.
And do you have a set kind of time scale to what you do? Do you get up and say, okay, breakfast, coffee, walk to the newsagent, hope it's shut, come back, start writing?
Yeah, I mean, I've got an affliction, which is like a kind of, I go into like, I think this has happened as I got older, of like cat mode, where I'll just sit in the sofa and then find I've been sitting there for hours just looking at the wall.
But you've been thinking, meanwhile.
I that's what I tell Amy.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that's what's happened. But there is a lot of kind of churning of thoughts and playing of video games and, finding... I mean, I've currently been buying cameras and taking photographs a lot, and I don't know why I'm doing that at the moment, but I am. And it's kind of... But it's like edging around to doing some
different
writing.
Different kind of technology, though. Different cameras.
Yeah, like film cameras and stuff.
Right, so... Yeah.
And taking photos and scanning. Anything not to do any writing. And then suddenly I'll do a load of writing and get it out of the way.
But so you don't write... You don't say, I'm going to write from 9 to 2 every day, or I'm going to write from...
No, I think I'm only good... I'm only good for about 2 hours, I think.
So do you worry about the word count, or is that not an issue?
I've taken to, and Amy laughs and laughs at this, is that I when I write scripts, often people listen to music in the scripts, and then I'll copy and paste the lyrics of songs into the scripts, so it fills up pages and pages and pages.
And then you have to take that all out.
Yeah, later, but yeah. It puffs the scripts up massively.
And what are you hitting? You're trying to hit 100 pages, 110?
Well, in a script, yeah, it's usually about, if I'm writing them for me, then they're about 80.
Right. But for you to direct, because you know what you're going to add.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I can bash through a script in 3 days if I have to.
Wow.
But it's not very good. No. But you know, it's on the page. And then I'll go back, and then it'll go in the drawer, and then I'll rewrite it, 2 months later.
So finishing it is the key, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's having... I think there's only a certain... For me, anyway, I've got a certain amount of energy, creative energy, for writing in me a day. And I can't go beyond that. It's just rubbish after that. So I kind of have three or four good ideas and write them down. And then, but I find it much easier if there's been a slightly crappy script that I've written and then I look at it and edit it. I can then get another couple of hours of work out of that. So.
And you cut and paste Anarchy into the UK entry. That's giving you another page.
More like a Pink Floyd song. Something goes on for about 4 minutes, 5 minutes.
King Crimson.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah. Yeah, or sometimes my characters like to quote poems, quite long poems.
That's, you know. Yeah, by the way.
Or counting.
I've been thinking a lot about Wordsworth.
Yeah. Isn't it romantic when you say 1 to 100? Is it? I don't know. Let's see.
This is like a screenwriting masterclass.
It's the way to do it, yeah. You know, to fill out those pages. They're tricksy. Or the other, I had a problem on a film a while back and they said, oh, this script's too long. We've got to lose 20 pages out of it. I'm like, really? So I just reformatted it.
Yes.
And they're like, that is not the point. I'm like, no, come on.
You can do it. Well, my wife is a screenwriter and she can normally save 3 pages off by reformatting.
Yeah.
Just clever reformatting. She'll often send in a script, I perhaps shouldn't say this, formatted longer. So she knows she's already got clever. 3 or 4 pages to come out when they say, can you lose 4 pages? Yep, I'm on it.
Easy.
Yeah.
Just make the font slightly smaller.
Yeah, slightly smaller and cut out some of the gaps.
Well, of course, in the UK, to working with UK companies or American companies, the actual pages are different sizes. So they're fatter and shorter, the American pages.
It's weird, isn't it? Yeah. It's weird how important that is. Because some people won't read it unless it's formatted in a certain
way. Well, because it's time by the minute. So it should, on average, be a minute per page. And if you're formatting it wrong, then you don't know where you are to budget it.
Favourite filmmakers?
Right. Off the top of my head.
Yeah. What do you mean off the top of your head? Like you haven't got that list in your head all the time. You haven't had this conversation on a regular basis with other film bores like me.
Scorsese is probably the most important filmmaker to me.
And why?
Because I remember renting Taxi Driver from the shop and thinking, and not knowing what it was, and thinking it had Danny DeVito in it.
So you were hoping it was Taxi the TV series?
Yeah, yeah, and all that. And then watching it and it blowing the top of my head off and going, oh my God, and never having that experience before.
I mean, to be fair, even if you knew what Taxi Driver was, when you first see it, it would still possibly blow the top of your head off because it's so amazing.
Yeah, but this was at a period where there's no, you know, obviously no internet, but there's no film books or anything. There's no chance of knowing what a film was.
Which,
you know,
in many ways, though, I think was a gift. We were lucky.
Yeah,
because
it's dangerous to go there as the old men of stroking our beards about how amazing the past was.
I'm just saying that in a way, I think we had it easier in a way, because now you do. It's very hard not to know what something's meant to be, and it's very hard not to know everyone's opinion about it before you even get a chance to sample it.
No, totally. And I think that the joy of, you know, someone turning up at your house with a bag full of VHS tapes and you hold them up and going, God, I've never seen that film by that director. That's, it's an Alan Rudolph movie. Let's have a look at that.
Joy of going down to your local, before Blockbuster, the local Guatty VHS store.
Yeah.
And going to the sort of like the exploitation nasty shelf.
Mm.
And just seeing, and inevitably, more than 9 out of 10, probably 90 out of 100, which is the same.
Yeah. I wasn't following that, but yeah, I guess you're right.
99 out of 100 would be terrible.
Yeah.
But you'd find one. Did you ever see that film? Was it called Possession?
Yeah,
with Sam. Is it Sam?
Yeah,
which was amazing.
Yeah,
and I got that the same day. I got something like, I don't know, you know, Basket Case, which is also fun, but a few terrible, terrible films. Mm. And then watching, I'm thinking, oh no, this is something different. This has some weird depth to it, which
I remember, I was it Magnum Force, Videodrome, Silver Bullet, and Scanners, I think, and watched them all in one session.
Wow.
And I'd never seen any of them.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, that's the mix.
That explains a lot about you. But what a great day that must have been.
It was. I was like, oh, I think Videodrome was in the middle as well. I was like, you know, you don't recover from that.
But Scanners is an amazing
film. Yeah, yeah.
Are you a fan of The Fury?
Yes. Yeah, yes. The De Palma one. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
See, that's underrated as
well. Yeah, and you made the connection because of the head explosion.
Yes,
yes.
Immediately.
Yeah.
I kind of was hoping that would be a whole new genre.
Or just the way every film ends. Yeah.
Please.
Or starts.
I know, we can't talk about it, but I know what Ben's doing next. Please have someone's head explode in it. I know it's not in the original.
Yeah, I think maybe every scene will end like that.
Just one scene off camera, right? And people won't know. I'll know it's there. You'll know it's there.
Just the sound of brains hitting a lampshade or something.
In the background, it's like period head explosion. That's what I want to see from Ben Wheatley. Ben, it's really nice. Thank you so much for giving me the time.
Well, thank you.
And I can't wait to see all your new films.
Cheers, man.
And your occasional foray into weird TV. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ben Wheatley. Okay, well, that's all we have time for in this edition. We'll be back in a week with a new one, and I will be talking to legendary American film director, huge hits to his name, Robert Zemeckis, or Bob Zemeckis, as I believe he likes me to call him now that we've bonded over a conversation. Of course, he did Back to the Future. He did Forrest Gump. He did Who Framed Roger Rabbit. There was A Christmas Carol, the Beowulf film. He's an interesting guy because he's very much at the forefront, I think, of bringing new technology into cinema, but making it work for the mainstream audience. So that's Robert Zemeckis in the next edition of I Like Films. This is Jonathan Ross saying thank you for listening. Please subscribe if you haven't done so already, and I'll be here next week.